Never lock the door.
So for folks just coming in, there's if you're looking for seating, there's still some. We got some space up front.
There's one chair over here,
and you can pass the news to people who are going to trickle in. Inevitably, there will be people trickling in. So my name is Sasha, and 8 years ago, I'm one of the people that founded the Icarus Project here in San Francisco.
Woohoo!
And we managed to grow into all kinds of interesting shapes over the years. But the thing that we've held down is this vision of trying to redefine what society thinks of as mental illness, and really reshape the language and culture that exists to talk about ourselves and to build community around that. And so lots of interesting community building has gone on over the years. You can find an enormous amount of fascinating information if you go to our website, theicarusproject.net. And then you'll find, here in the Bay Area, there's a lot of interesting folks who are working on the Icarus Project. Like Danny.
Well, I'm Danny, and I'm involved in the local Bay Area Icarus, and we would love for you all to join us. We have meetings in this building every Sunday from 4:30 to 6:30, and those are sort of our support meetings. And then we also have organizing meetings, which you can come to if you're interested in doing more of the organizing side of things and doing radical mental health activism. So. Also, another thing that we recently started was the speaker series, which you are currently at, in case you were wondering. And this is the second event. Last month we had Robert Whitaker, who talked about his book, Anatomy of an Epidemic. And this month we are very, very pleased to have Ethan Waters, who wrote the book, Crazy Like Us, The Globalization of the American Psyche. And he's a really awesome local author, started the San Francisco Writer's Grotto, has written in a lot of national magazines, and has this excellent book.
I guess the last thing I'll say before we turn it over to Ethan is that probably, a bunch of people in this room, I ended up reading that New York Times article that he wrote back in January that was a summary of the larger book, and it was really a very powerful... It was a really very powerful analysis of what's happening with the globalization of the medical model spreading around the world, and it's just such an honor to have him here so that we can actually not just talk about it, but then talk about what we want to do about it. So, give a big round.
I am a local writer, actually, one of the founders of the San Francisco Writer's Grotto. And if you look out the window there, there's a condo that stands in the very place that we had for 5 years, the one iteration of the San Francisco Writers' Grotto with 21 writers, and it was we were booted out, and that big condo building right there was moved. So part of the idea for this book was formed just a block away from here. So there's we've changed our plan, and I came here with an hour-long speech to give you. And we decided at the last minute to shift the plan, because this book is not intended to be didactic and teachy. It's intended to be an opening of a conversation about a way of thinking about mental illness and illness narratives around the world. And I can't imagine an audience I'd more rather have that conversation with. So I'd like to maybe introduce some of the themes in the book, and then have a conversation about it. And we can there can be questions and comments, and I think that's going to be more interesting and fun than me giving my hour-long presentation. Hope that doesn't deeply disappoint anyone. I've had some interesting conversations about this book since it came out in January. One of them was a very brief conversation when I was invited to go on The Daily Show with Jon Stewart. Such a strange and disorienting experience that... I ended up writing about the experience, and I wrote the top 10 things you need to know before you go on The Daily Show, which if you hang with me for the evening in our discussion, I will share with you at the very end, I'll share with you the top 10 things you need to know before going on The Daily Show.
What's the number one?
Oh, you'll have to wait. that's the dessert for the meal. So the book is about this sort of remarkable body of research that suggests that mental illnesses are not, as sometimes assumed, evenly spread around the world and the same over time. In fact, that there is this great body of knowledge that suggests that culture deeply influences the expression of mental illnesses. You might know some examples in the literature. Ian Hacking, in his book Mad Travelers, wrote about a fugue state that just would, a transient fugue state in Victorian era England, where young men would walk for hundreds of miles with no sense of their identity and no memory of the events that took place. I came to think of mental illnesses kind of as the lightning in the zeitgeist, the combination of culture and biology and beliefs about the mind in a particular moment in history and a particular culture. And because those beliefs change and are different in different times and places, expressions of mental illnesses often look remarkably different from one time and place to another. So, you know, to take another obvious example, the hysterical leg paralysis experienced by hundreds and thousands of Victorian-era women gives us a visceral understanding, I think, of the times they lived in. But let me be clear from the start. When I say this, doesn't have anything to do with people faking their illnesses. This is what the unconscious mind does when it becomes distressed. It looks to understand the language of suffering for its moment in history. Symptoms of mental illness can be thought of like communications. The unconscious mind goes and looks for which communications will be understood for their moment in history. And those communications are based largely upon the group understanding of the human mind, how it works, and what it means. So because the troubled mind has been perceived in all these different ways, as I said, the forms of madness look very different from one time and place to another. But, and this is the other thesis of the book, with the increasing speed of globalization and because of the tremendous cultural power the West and America in particular has over categorizing these beliefs, telling people what they are, how they should be treated, how to think about them, that we are in fact homogenizing the world's beliefs about these mental illnesses, and in doing so, homogenizing the expressions of those illnesses as well, because as I suggest, mental illnesses are tied to cultural beliefs about them. So that we are homogenizing the way the world goes mad. So let me tell you just a little story about, as a journalist writing about these topics, I'm always looking for stories by which to take these rather large ideas and sort of to give them a human face and so forth. And I can tell you the first moment when I knew I was going to write this book, I had gone up to McGill University to do a story about an entirely different topic, about epigenetics, which is a fascinating topic of its own. But I took the afternoon off because I wanted to talk to Lawrence Kermayer, who's the head of the cross-cultural psychiatry department up there, because I had this little inkling of this idea about this book, and I wanted to try it out on him. And no sooner did I sit down and ask him about this idea about the connection between culture and globalization and the expression of mental illness, than he told me a story of being invited by GlaxoSmithKline to a conference in Japan in 2000. And as you probably know, it's not unusual for Big Pharma to sponsor academic conferences and to treat academics and clinicians with great care. But Kermayer got the idea very early on that something was different about this conference. He was first told that there would be no press, no grad students, that this would entirely be a sort of a closed conference between GlaxoSmithKline and these leaders in the world of cross-cultural psychiatry. And then the plane ticket arrived, and it was a first-class plane ticket to Japan. And Dr. Kermayer is not used, as an academic, not used to flying in the front of the plane. Got to Japan, and it was this palatial suite, just this remarkable hotel, one of these very exclusive places. And he said it was one of these places where you walk in the room, and there's your bath is already drawn for you, and it's strewn with this fragrant oil. And he said there was a plate of fruit on the credenza that was so exotic he could only identify the mangosteens. He had no idea what the other fruits were. And he said this was, he told me, this was Gordon Gekko treatment. And he said it made him a little uncomfortable, and he began to wonder well, what did I do to deserve this? So GlaxoSmithKline, you see, had made a very big bet that it could sell its antidepressant Paxil to Japan. But there was no guarantee that the Japanese doctors or the Japanese public would be interested in taking it. Japan does have a mental illness that roughly parallels depression, often translated as endogenous depression, considered for the most part, at least before 2000, is to be a rather rare condition and an extremely severe mental illness. So Japan, of course, did have other experiences of sadness. It's just there was a cultural difference between Japan and America in terms of where the line was between pathological sadness and normal sadness. And Japan, anthropologists will tell you, as a culture, has somewhat of an embrace of the experience of sadness. They look at it as often look at it as a way to find moral guidance and not a state, an emotional state to be fearful of. And that's sort of fundamentally the disconnect between the American notions of sadness, where it's a state you need to get away from as quickly as possible. So during that Kyoto meeting that Kamer was invited to by GlaxoSmithKline, he slowly began to understand why GlaxoSmithKline was so interested in his knowledge about how cultures shape the illness experience. To make Paxil a hit in Japan as it was in America, it would simply not be enough to corner the market on that so-called endogenous depression. Their objective was to change, at the most fundamental level, the Japanese understanding of sadness and depression. In short, they wanted to learn how to market a disease. And to have the best chance of shifting that cultural public's perception about the meaning of depression, GlaxoSmithKline needed a deep and sophisticated understanding about how those beliefs had taken shape. And that is why Kramer came to realize that the company had invited him and his colleagues and treated them like such royalty. But GlaxoSmithKline needed help solving a cultural puzzle that might be worth $1 billion. And indeed, they had the right man. Kramer knew, perhaps better than anyone else in the world, how cultures differ in their expression of depression-like states. He had studied, for instance, how a Nigerian man might feel a culturally distinct form of depression by experiencing a peppery feeling in his head. He knew that a rural Chinese farmer might speak only of shoulder aches or stomach pains, how a man in India might talk of semen loss or of sinking heart. He studied how Koreans spoke of fire illness, which is experiences of burning in the gut, and how American Indians have a notion of depression that is roughly akin to the sense of loneliness. Kramer had observed that culture, in short, differ in what he calls explanatory models of depression-like states. The cultural beliefs and stories have the effect of directing the attention of individuals to certain feelings and symptoms and away from others. In one culture, someone feeling an inchoate distress might be prompted to search for feelings of unease in their gut or in muscle pain. In another time and place, a different symptom would be accepted as legitimate. And this interplay between the expectation of the culture and the experience of the individual leads to that symptom amplification. Some symptoms become salient, understood, expressions of illnesses legitimized, and they become felt more deeply than others in a different time and place. And the upshot is that beliefs about the cause and symptomology and course of the illness, such as depression, tend to be self-fulfilling. Explanatory models create the culturally expected experience of the disease in the mind of the sufferer. Well, that's much nicer. So Kamer knew that the cultural beliefs about depression and the self are malleable and responsive to messages that can be exported from one culture to another. One culture can reshape how a population in another culture categorizes a given set of symptoms and redraws the line demarcating the normal behavior from and internal states from those considered pathological. So as a writer, I was blown away by the story Kramer was telling me, both on a large scale, but also on the scale that writers love the details that make stories jump to life. And I love the way he told the stories about the plate of fruit and the first-class plane ticket. But I also wanted to make sure right away at that first meeting I had with him, whether I understood what he was saying. And I wanted to know, in particular, how intentional GlaxoSmithKline was being in this manipulation. Or was this simply sort of another expression of the march of globalization. And so I asked him, I said, how, during these meetings you had with Atlas McLean, how clear was it that this is what they were about? And this is what he said to me. He said, it was very explicit. What I was witnessing was a multinational pharmaceutical corporation working hard to redefine narratives about mental health, he said. These changes have far-reaching effects in forming the cultural conceptions of personhood and how people conduct their everyday lives, and this is happening on a global scale. We are upending long-held cultural beliefs about the meaning of illness and healing. And it was quite literally at that moment when I realized that, that this was a book that was really worth spending, you know, 3 years of my life writing. So the thesis of the book, I think I've already laid clear. There are four chapters in the book. One has to do with GlaxoSmithKline's intervention in Japan and how it manipulates culture to change people's beliefs about where the line between normal and the pathological are. The next chapter, or the other chapters are, the one is about the rise of anorexia in Hong Kong in the 90s. I follow a guy named Sing Lee, who is a psychiatrist, who was studying anorexia in China in the 80s, an extremely rare condition, and had this particularly Chinese aspects to it. It didn't have, as it often does in the United States, it didn't have body dysmorphia, it didn't have fat phobia, it didn't seem to connect it to diet or exercise trends. But then something shifted in the mid-90s, and something changed that landscape such that the American form of anorexia rose suddenly. And this was a sort of a remarkable thing, and the case I make in the book is that symptom pools, this goes to the idea, Edward Schroeder's idea of symptom pool, which is that any time and place in human history, there are a set of symptoms that a troubled mind will attach itself to. And those symptom pools change over time. And that in the 80s in Hong Kong, there simply wasn't the symptom in the symptom pool, and then suddenly there was. And the case I make is that there was a single death of a girl in a downtown Hong Kong street in 1994 in Hong Kong, and it caught the media's attention. And she was clearly an anorexic. She fell and died in the middle of downtown Hong Kong street. And the press had to explain what this illness was. What did it mean? Who was at risk? What were the symptoms? And basically what they did is they turned to the West, and they turned to Western experts. And we are only too happy to help in these cases. We've done the most research about diseases like anorexia. And we said, this is what it is. It is has these symptoms. It affects this population. And the truth is, and up to that point in Hong Kong, it had not had those symptoms. It had not affected that population, and it was only after the massive media attention surrounding this one death that you saw the rise of the American form of the disease. So my belief is that anorexia can follow cultural currents such as exercise fads, diet trends, fashion, but it can also follow other cultural currents. And one of the cultural currents we have to be very careful about is the cultural dialogue about mental illness itself. So when we come into another culture and we say, this is the disease you're looking at, and this is what it means, we often get tremendous play in the media. And unfortunately, I think in this case, we, at a very nervous time in Hong Kong's history, remember this is 94, this is after Tiananmen Square had happened on the mainland, before that handover to Chinese rule, families were being ripped apart through immigration, quickly changing roles for women, very troubled time, but there is no one way for the human creature to express that distress. That's when the subconscious goes looking for the symptom pool of the time to be understood. And what behaviors and beliefs and symptoms are in that symptom pool depends a great deal on the discourse about that symptom pool and mental health professionals, journalists, and the people that write the DSM have a great deal to do. They're not simply observing this thing and putting it in books. They are, in part, shaping the symptom pools. And as we go across cultures, this is happening more and more. Third chapter is about post-traumatic stress disorder and our interventions when we rush into cultures after natural disasters. And the example that I play out in that chapter is Sri Lanka after the Boxing Day tsunami, and I document the many ways in which Western trauma counselors rushed in, oftentimes with a PTSD checklist, believing that this surely, out of all things, surely this is a universal human reaction to trauma, and this is culturally neutral, and we can help. Well, anthropologists will tell you that that is simply incorrect, that there are many ways to express trauma, and indeed, the expectations, our visceral reaction to a moment of trauma may be universal. The panic, the adrenaline, the fight or flight. But the moment after that, when we begin to sort of give meaning to this event, we look to culture. What does this mean? Where do I find solace? And cultures differ on which, again, which symptoms are salient, which are meaningful. And they certainly differ on how to think about healing from the trauma. Our notions of trauma are not universal, either in their symptomology or in the healing modalities. One, you know, to drive this point home, one of the anthropologists I talked to said, just imagine that scenario reversed. So imagine after 9/11 or after Katrina, the healers from Mozambique came over and began knocking on the doors of the survivors and saying, I need to lead you through this set of rituals in order for you to sever your relationship from the dead. Would that make sense as a, you know, cultural, you know, would that make sense? And of course it wouldn't, but we have no problem, it appears, doing the opposite. And I think I know why, which is that I think we believe that every generation of mental health healers has the tendency to believe that their beliefs about mental illness are suddenly beyond culture, that we've finally erased the mistakes. They can always see the mistakes of the past generation, like, oh yeah, that was clearly a culturally based belief, but now we're pretty much down to the science of it, and we're not shaped by our cultural beliefs. And I think the truth is that we are always shaped by our cultural beliefs, and even the briefest look at the development of PTSD from its incarnation as post-Vietnam syndrome to what it is today indicates that this is a belief that is laden with cultural beliefs about the mind. They're not necessarily wrong, but they're not universal. And certainly our ideas about healing are not universal. And I think specifically in Sri Lanka, when anthropologists go in and study the people of Sri Lanka and try to understand what their reaction to trauma is, oftentimes it's very different than the Western notion of it. They tend to believe that a person that does very badly after a trauma like the tsunami is someone that is failing in their social roles, who has become disconnected from their group. And that is a sort of fundamental distinction from our current model of PTSD, which is that PTSD exists in here, not in your role in the group. It may affect that role in the group, but it fundamentally exists in here, so it makes a lot of sense maybe to take time away from your responsibilities in order to heal from it. For a Sri Lankan, the very disconnect from their responsibilities is often the expression of the illness they're experiencing. They have tied together the social and the psychological, and trying to tease them apart makes little sense to them. And so the idea of, for instance, individual trauma counseling after an event may just seem bizarre. And I think that goes to the sort of fundamental distinction between a sort of sociocentric view of the self, which a lot of the rest of the world has and certainly exists in Sri Lanka, and sort of the more egocentric version of the self, which we tend to be big proponents of here in America, that the ego exists here. Other cultures, the ego exists connected to the group, and the troubles with the self are also connected to troubles within the group. And there are places where they have not yet separated the individual sense of health from the group's sense of health. So, Goxis McClain of Japan, anorexia, PTSD, and then the last chapter is about schizophrenia and the biomedical notions of the disease. And that one took me the farthest away from home I've ever traveled. I traveled down to Zanzibar to talk with a researcher there named Julie Magruder, who was trying to figure out this remarkable puzzle that was in the literature. And the puzzle was a World Health Organization study that came out and discovered, and I think Robert Whitaker probably talked about this, discovered that basically the people people with schizophrenia in developing countries oftentimes do better than people with schizophrenia in the first world and developed countries. Multi-decade study done by the World Health Organization and no one's been able to explain it. And there's lots of theories about why that might be. Robert Whitaker believes it has something to do with the fact that people they get less drugs and they may do better. Julie Magruder had the theory that there are cultural beliefs in play here that also might be different. And she went down and she did what great anthropologists do, and she went down and she sat with three families who were dealing with a mentally ill individual, and sat with them and discovered and tried to figure out what were they saying about this illness, how did they conceive of it, what did it mean to them, and what was their relationship like with the ill individual. And she came to the belief that the spirit possession beliefs that were employed in Zanzibar were actually not, as we might imagine, ostracizing or stigmatizing, but they were actually ways in which the family kept the ill individual within the group, gave the ill individual during times of remission, an easier way back into their place in the group, and that these were actually lowered the level of what is often called in the literature expressed emotion, which is people have studied families of people with schizophrenia and discovered that high expressed emotion families, people that are very critical of the ill individual, or maybe not critical, but overly involved in their cognition, always monitoring, tended to have the family members with the highest relapse rates and the worst outcomes. And so Julie Magruder came to believe that the spirit possession narrative, as applied in Zanzibar, lowered the levels of expressed emotion, allowed the family to reduce the stigma both around the ill individual and around the family, because it is not expected for anyone to be able to control the vagaries of the spirit world. And I think that literature on the expressed emotion stuff is really fascinating, because what it suggests, people who have studied it across cultures have found that expressed emotion does appear to be a salient factor in relapse rates and so forth, culture to culture as you go. But cultures differ in their average levels of expressed emotion, how many families are highly critical or overly intrusive into the lives of their ill relatives. Can anyone guess which culture has the highest level of expressed emotion? And I probably telegraphed the answer, which is Anglo-Americans have the highest level of expressed emotions. And it seems at first like a criticism, like I'm saying, like, you know, Americans are more critical, or Americans lack the tolerance to deal with their mentally ill relatives. But I think what it is, I just took credit for an idea that is really Jill Hooley's at Harvard University. She wanted to know what was the difference between the high and the low expressed emotion families. And so she studied them on an interesting spectrum, which is the locus of control. This is the spectrum by which you have a belief about your mind that is either I'm the captain of my own ship and it's right in here, or my locus of control is more outward within the group. And there's a set of questions you ask people to find out where their locus of control is. So I can always make my plans come through. It would be something that someone with a highly centered locus of control would say. I can only do things if other people help me, or I'm really not in control of my own behavior. It would be a decentralized locus of control. And studying the families with high expressed emotions, the families that really wanted to intrude into the lives of their ill individuals, they found that those family members tended to have a highly localized locus of control. Though they had the belief about the human mind that it was in here and not out here. And so they weren't being cruel to their mentally ill relatives. They weren't being mean. They were simply applying their same belief about the mind that they had to their ill relative, with the assumption that they could control their behavior. And Julie Magruder said to me, I'm going to mess up this quote, but she said, Western individuals have such fear about mental illness because it's really that overturns a fundamental belief that we share about the human mind, and we become sort of abject when confronted by mentation that appears more malleable, more permeable to outside sources than we believe our own to be. And I think that's very true, and I think that's why we often address, in the West, address these illness experiences with such a level of concern, and we want to fix it, And indeed, with illnesses that are pervasive and long-term, oftentimes that's simply not really the option. And there is a way that other cultures have learned to tell stories about these illnesses that, I don't want to say accept the illness, but that lower that level of intensity in attacking it. And I think the literature on expressed emotion would suggest that there is a good deal to be said for that, the stories that allow us to do that. And I feel like that may be in the end what the Icarus Project is about, is telling a different story about these experiences that they don't have, let's fix it at the, you know, at the sort of as the lead of the story. So that's the four chapters of the book. And I think that's a good summary. I would love to, at this point, open it up to a conversation about the book. I do also want to say I brought some books that the profit was going to go to the Icarus Project. I would love for you to grab one of those books and contribute to the Icarus Project on the way out and continue the dialogue with me in some other form. But mostly I'm interested in having starting a conversation tonight about it, if that seems appropriate. Who would like to jump in and start that conversation? Yes.
So I've actually spent some time in Hong Kong and know some people who are doing what they're sort of seeing as more indigenous forms of mental health. They're sort of cultivating some sort of indigenous psychotherapy where you bring in some, say, beliefs from Chinese philosophy, Chinese medicine. I'm curious what you think about this, because I think that also ends up missing the point in the way we talk about culture in a globalizing era, that it's not as though those beliefs, the young people actually hold those beliefs, they do in the same way that maybe a previous generation would have. And how do we address what you're saying without sort of fetishizing some sort of old culture?
Yes, yeah, the classic mistake of the young anthropologists is to see, like, oh, there's this culture that is, you know, pure and pristine and it has some sort of deeper connection and we need to go back to that. And the bottom line is simply that's not possible. So it's almost like it's a moot point. Like, should we go back to a time when cultures were distinct or more distinct from another? Well, that time is long gone, and it's not coming back. So something else has to happen. So I ask every cross-cultural anthropologist I interviewed over time, I said, what does the future hold? Are these tides going to turn? What's going to happen over the next 10 years? Some variation on that question. And to a person, they said, the tide is too strong. The way these cultural ideas are flowing across borders and certainly from West to other places, the momentum is too great and the money behind it oftentimes is too much. So it's not going to be possible to turn back the clock. And so the question is, what's the best hope given that those scenarios? I do think the best hope is at least having the sense that the information and the cultural beliefs might go both ways, that we might learn ideas of other cultures that we bring to America as we teach the rest of the world how to think like us. And I also think that to the extent that America has good science and good research and maybe develops effective drugs over time to help people, we should share that with the world. I'm not suggesting that we shouldn't. But I wonder in the end, and I have to say my anthropologist in Zanzibar, Julie Magruder, had an experience which is sort of the end of the chapter on her, on schizophrenia in Africa, and she came back, she studied, sat with these family, came back to Tacoma where she was a professor at Puget Sound University up there, and went back to work on her dissertation, and her husband, who had been with her in Zanzibar, had a psychotic break. He had a manic psychotic mania. Got arrested, thrown into the psychiatric ward there. And so here was this anthropologist that had studied all these ways in which people in Zanzibar ameliorate these sort of experiences. And she thought, well, I can put some of this into use. Religious beliefs, she tried to sort of maybe explore the husband's shared religious beliefs and see if that would help. They didn't have family nearby. The structure of the culture was so different. And what she found was that all her knowledge really could not be imported. The ways this knowledge gets employed in Zanzibar was not importable to American, because it was layered into their culture in such a way that you could not. It's not a parallel. We send drugs over there and we can get this great bit of knowledge. That knowledge is really embedded in a culture, and it's very difficult to extract it. So it's easier to do what we're doing, and it's harder for the knowledge to come our way. But I do hope that some way we can employ other knowledge about the mind that we find in other cultures.
Yeah, I actually want to hold out a bit of hope on that level, because I believe your research actually confirms something that we know from our studies in certain kinds of mental illness in this country, that providing what is called a validating environment, which is an environment that does accept, and I hope you don't actually pull back from using that term accept, as you've indicated in your speech, because I actually think it's quite apt. In that we know actually now that providing the accepting, validating environment actually does ameliorate certain forms of mental illness. And so I guess what I want to say is I do think there's hope when we do these cross-cultural studies and we find confirmation of this process as you presented, that it supports our own scientific studies. And if we can find a way to implement that in a culturally appropriate manner here in this country, and there are treatments now, there are evidence-confirmed treatments that make use of that concept, that we can actually implement that and perhaps as well figure out how to export it, as you indicated, to the rest of the world as well.
I also think as a culture we can do some deep thinking about that idea of where the mind exists in terms of the spectrum of egocentric versus sociocentric, and I think clearly you find in America this sort of egocentric, and I just, ultimately I believe, I mean, it's a spectrum, but way over here the egocentric version of the mind I think does not really exist. It's a myth we tell about ourselves. We are deeply affected by the cultural stories that surround us and permeate our unconscious. There's just no getting around it. So, and I do think we are healthier and happier when we are connected to groups. And this belief that groups are simply sort of, you know, ways to, for us as individuals to, you know, to get ahead, or I don't know, other version of the group. I think, and I do see things, you know, the Icarus Project being one of them, of ways people are manifesting that, deeply understand that they're not, that the best way to think about the self is not the captain of your own ship, you know, charting the world.
I hate to take the more pessimistic, dark view of this, but I mean, when I read your book, and I've been thinking about this for quite some time, I mean, there's two parts of it. I mean, to get away from that egocentric, this internal locus of control idea, I think goes to the very heart of the capitalist discourse. It'd be almost like nearly impossible to take that out of the larger discourse on how capitalism happens. And so that's my first sort of like, oof, well, I'd love for that to be true. But it's like everything hinges on that, absolutely everything, that we can have it all, that, as Freud said, we're the masters of, you know, of our
destiny,
in our own house, which is obviously untrue. You brought up the whole idea of the unconscious. I think that speaks to the fact that we're not masters of our own house. But going further, in terms of really the germ of your book, and that I find that this is where the tragedy is, and it's of such epic proportions, because it's so insidiously, like, invisible, is that just the very sort of, the massive difference in human experience is being erased.
Yeah.
I know you're saying this, but it's just like, I mean, when I sit there and think about it, it's almost unbearable. It's like, oh my, you know, I mean, this is colonialism taken to the sort of the nth degree. And that for me is very difficult to hold, right? And it's really sad. It's like, we don't necessarily need to go invade other countries. We don't necessarily need to, you know, create whole new financial systems necessarily, because if we change subjectivity from within, that takes care of everything else.
Right.
And I guess I'm bringing it up, so I do want to take it there. But there is a part of me that's like, oh God, I'm just going to be hard to sleep tonight. I mean, there's so much, right? But I mean, it really goes there. Yeah. And I really applaud your courage in going there, because this is not easy. This is incredibly difficult to sort of bear.
You know, the people I talked to over the course of writing this book, sort of the parallel that I came to believe in, that I kind of began to think of them as biologists in the rainforest, who are discovering these new sort of plants and animals just one step ahead of the bulldozer, you know, just at the time when we're, you know, finally giving voice and meaning to them, they were really disappearing in front of our eyes. And it is a tragedy, and I think we could lose those beliefs and understandings of the mind, and they could become extinct to the human mind, just in the same way a plant or animal can become extinct. Yes,
ma'am. You know what this brought up for me was some years ago I went to a lecture by Stanley Krippner, who used to teach here, okay, sometimes, and it was about a woman in Peru with multiple personality. And there, you know, they brought out the shaman, and it was considered to be, it was one of her past lives that was, in one case, was concerned that her housekeeping wasn't very good, because in her past life she'd been a very good housekeeper. Now she was very messy, so there was some stress from that. So they sort of sat down and made deals about how much better it should get and stuff, and then everything was fine. And her life went on, and the problem went away. And I thought, what a wonderful way to do it. We should do that.
Yeah. You know, more and more I've become agnostic about the truth or falsehood of the narrative that surrounds mental illness. I'm not, myself, for instance, a believer in spirit possession as a cause for schizophrenic symptoms, nor is Julie Magruder, by the way. But you can look at these things in another way and say, well, what's the outcome of that belief? And I think one critical and easy way to judge those outcomes is to say, does that narrative exclude the individual, ill individual from the group, or does that include the ill individual in the group? And I have to say that the biomedical belief about mental illness, which I tend to be oriented towards that, I'm from the West, my wife is a psychiatrist, I tend to think of that as the right way to think about it, and the true thing is biomedical, cultural biomedical. And I think, well, if that's the truth, we should share that with the rest of the world. Well, unfortunately, what you find is as we have gone around the world and spreading this belief saying, really, you should think about mental illness just as like any other disease. It's going to lessen the stigma. And what you find is we've won this rhetorical battle, or we're winning it, but stigma is on the rise around the world. And people that have studied why the stigma is on the rise have discovered that people who tend to believe in the biomedical genetic story about mental illness also tend to be the ones that want less to do with the mentally ill, think of them as more dangerous, more unpredictable, and more permanently broken than the other stories that are told about mental illness. It was caused by something in my childhood or some other story. So the very belief that we have that the biomedical belief is true and therefore it will reduce mental stigma is simply not turning out to be true. Which leaves you in the sort of ethical quandary of, well, if we believe it's true, and we believe, shouldn't we be sharing that truth with the rest of the world? But if that truth has a bad outcome, what do you do?
I think you're leaving something out. You're looking at it from the point of view of the doctors and the psychiatrists and the therapists. And what I've seen from being active in this movement is get rid of bigotry, because I don't like that word. We have to do it.
Yeah.
Look at gay people in this country. They're in the same situation that I am as an ex-mental patient or a psych survivor. Everybody despised them too.
Yeah.
And they said, we're not taking this anymore. And that didn't come from some advice from some therapist or from the National Alliance for Mental Illness. It came from them. So I think let's not lose sight of the fact that we have a whole lot of responsibility for ourselves, and our salvation isn't going to come from therapists or psychiatrists or even well-meaning, I don't mean this as an attack, but in the sound, not even from well-meaning journalists either. It had to come from us.
Yeah. I think if there's an underlying positive aspect of the ideas in the book is that if you begin to understand how much culture influences your fundamental beliefs about yourself, if you truly understand to the extent that that is in play, then I think it opens up a modicum of personal choice in terms of who you give the power to define you by, like who you give the power to give you that label. And you get to. I don't think there's any avoiding culture. There's no way to simply get out from under culture. You will always be influenced by cultural understandings of the mind, but you have a choice as to who's going to be the leader of the group that you join, or whether you're going to be the leader yourself, or and so forth. And again, I think it feels like the Icarus Project is about claiming that control, and we will localize our culture, and we will be in charge of it. And I think that's a positive outcome.
Yes. I'm curious if, over the course of your travels and research and talking to different people, as you're creating this book, you found any culture, person, treatment, perspective, program that is doing something really well that we could use here, and that might translate. Are there any interesting models or people out there working on things that we're missing as
right.
our own culture?
That's a good question. I didn't see, I didn't find like the holy grail of the community where it's all making sense. And I do at every chapter of the book, take this, our interventions abroad, and say, okay, that's how malleable notions of trauma are in Sri Lanka. What does that mean to our own creation of these ideas, and how they evolved over time? What is the rise of anorexia and the way they popularized that notion in the press in Hong Kong mean about the 1970s and Karen Carpenter's death and the way we did that here, and what does it mean to a eating disorder expert or a journalist that wants to do that? So the lesson I'm hoping to bring home is not some specific treatment or other, but simply a knowledge that culture moves and shifts these things, and that we need to reconceive of our own narratives about mental health with that knowledge. But ultimately, I think probably the answer to your question is,
wow, this is cool moment.
Oh, lots of them. I mean, it was just a wonderful time. I have to say, as a journalist and a writer, like getting to write this book and getting to go to Zanzibar, and there were really disturbing moments and moments where I just thought the whole world was opening up to me. And also the excitement as a journalist that you were onto something that the people in the general population sort of had not yet been aware of, and that you were going to be the conduit to these great ideas. And I just, I love just about every minute of it. Yes, in the back.
First of all, thank you so much for your book and for coming tonight. My question isn't really going to be well formulated, because I'm having a hard time actually clarifying what my question is. But one thing I want to kind of speak to, maybe respond to this, is you mentioned at one point that the unconscious goes looking for symptom pools to express its distress. What that still suggests is this black box of distress.
Yes.
That seems to precede the expression of it.
Yeah.
And if you look at, for example, schizophrenia or symptoms of signs that we would identify as schizophrenia in Zanzibar, the comparison of how a family responds to those behaviors or experiences doesn't touch that initial distress, right? It's just how we name or describe it. But what I'm interested in then is, for example, in Japan, where for anorexia in China, are we actually creating the distress? And it seems to me that's something different. It's why if we can't really extract ourselves from the cultural framework for how we understand pain or feeling unhappy or whatever, then is it more than simply identifying treatments or language for naming something, and more of actually creating the pain itself?
So two things I'd say about that. One is, one of my cases is that shaping of it has far more meaning and momentum than we give it credit for now. It's not simply naming, it has this whole, it gives a momentum behind this these behaviors and beliefs. That's one thing I'd say. Two is I would say that globalization is causing, I think, a great deal of distress. So you have in the Japan of the 1990s was, of course, there, this horrible recession period, high suicide rates, incredible work ethic going nowhere, and it was a population in distress. China in 1994, as I suggested, was this population just in the midst of this incredible change. So it's this remarkable thing where I do think the deterioration of traditions and local communities and local senses of self are greatly distressful. And it's, so it's a 1-2 punch, you know, so we are an engine of this change and this globalization, and then we come in and we give people labels for the distress that we are partly causing. So I think that, but I also would say that I think in any population in human history, you will have what Sing Lee called a general loading of psychopathology. There will be a percent of people, for whatever reasons, very personal or very broadly social, that are having trouble and that look to culture to say, give me a name for this, give me a symptom. And they're doing this unconsciously, this is really important, unconsciously, without their knowledge, their mind goes shopping for the symptom pool of the time. So I do think globalization is both on the creation side, but I also think that in any population in human history, you will find people with in distress doing this unconscious thing.
I'm curious about your personal experience since the book has come out.
Yeah.
Like,
besides going on the Daily Show.
What kind of reaction have you gotten? Has there been any pushback from people, from professionals in the field?
It's been really interesting.
What was the question?
So the question was, what has been the reaction from people in the field to the book? And it's been remarkably 90% positive, but positive in this weird way, which is that people say, oh yeah, that argument you're making is absolutely right about my friend down the hall. I, however, when I go into other cultures, I really understand this, and I know how to weave around these potential habits. So it's a very easy argument to see about someone else. But whether people actually sort of like take this argument and then look in the mirror very often is... I kind of doubt it. I mean, it goes against sort of fundamental sort of human nature to see yourself as the bad actor, especially in moments when you feel like you're the really good actor. Remarkably, people have accepted the argument, but it's never about them. So no. All the way in the back.
Yeah, I wanted to say that as a psychologist who volunteered for 2 months in Samoa after the tsunami, I can only say I wish I could read the book before I read. And I can say that I was not one of the people that you were just referring to. And I feel that I may have done more harm than good. So your book is wonderful. I think it's the most provocative since maybe Thomas Zass came out with it. It's a wonderful, wonderful book. My question is, are you familiar with the movement, the Mad Pride movement that started in Scotland about
I don't know much about that. You want to tell a little bit about that?
Well, it's the gentleman in front just alluded to some parallels. Well, maybe some predictions with it along the lines of the gay pride movement in the 70s of people being pathologized and then sort of throwing off those chains and saying, "How will this work? We're not taking it anymore." And we're going to develop our own community and our own culture. And that's essentially what the Mad Pride movement seems to be doing. And I've just spent 5 years in New Zealand, and it's very big there. It's taken off to a large degree, and people are starting to challenge the professional view of their particular diagnosis and what it means, and to try and demand more accountability for the health system and also autonomy for the community, and building a community and having cultural events and developing a culture of madness, quote unquote, of people who are diagnosed primarily with bipolar disorder and schizophrenia, and developing music, poetry, writing around it. And it just struck me as a very, I found it very inspiring. I would just love to look at
I need to do an article or something about that, because I do think there are flip sides to this, to my dark book that I need to sort of embrace. And I appreciate what you said about, I'm glad you didn't take that chapter about Sri Lanka as a personal attack, Mike.
Oh, no, it was wonderful. It's a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful book. I mean, I think your book is going to have a huge huge effect on the arts. I haven't seen anything as provocative in 20 years. I only wish it had been part of my training.
Well, I mean, after talking to a lot of the healers that went to Sri Lanka, I want to say one thing, which is that this is often not sort of a hegemonic us forcing our ideas down the throats of an indigenous population. This is oftentimes, quite literally, the rest of the world reaching out for this information and this knowledge and what they think, this technology and beliefs and science they think exists in the West that they need.
You made that point very clearly. You didn't have a question
in the past. Oh, good. Because this is not simply us doing that. It's, and indeed, healers that went there and described this to me, they said, like, I wanted to take the lead of the local healers, and you get put in a room, and you're the guy from the West, and here's the microphone, and what do you know? And it's hard to let that role go.
People value American culture way more than they should. That's for sure. But what I really put my hand up for was a fellow in the back who talked about the My Pride Museum. Can we please connect at the end of this meeting? I really want to hear more about it.
So he wants to chat with you about the terrific.
I really appreciate it. Thanks.
Yes?
I was wondering how conscious art cultures are of what you just described. You know, it's very obvious kind of mental malaxation, organization, all that. So, how do they react to it? I mean, it's got to be obvious to some people. There is some network thing going on to say, like, well, we got to make this combination between them and us instead of just being washed over. Because it's not just on the mental health issue, it's
about... It's about everything. And there are pushbacks. There are pushbacks, and oftentimes this comes... So the Japan example, I'm writing about it 8 years after the fact. So GlaxoSmithKline came in with this very effective campaign to move where the line was between the pathological and the normal, very effective. And then there are a series of mental health healers who were co-opted into that movement who have now suddenly said, hold on a second, the amount of people that are now diagnosing themselves as or being diagnosed as depressed, and the amount of Paxil and other antidepressants that are being taken in Japan is wrong. GlaxoSmithKline came up with this phrase for depression, which was, depression is the cold of the soul, which implies that everyone gets it, it's easily treatable, you take a pill. And they were tremendously effective in that campaign. And one of the psychiatrists I talked to said, who was literally one of the lead psychiatrists that GlaxoSmithKline sort of bought during that time to promote this idea, says this was a mistake, and maybe we could go back and sell it as the cancer of the soul, so people would be less interested. Which is a sort of a funny idea, of course, but just ridiculous on many levels. One of which is that even if he decided to do this, where would be the $500 million budget to do it with that GlaxoSmithKline had to do the opposite? So there is pushback. The pushback tends to. It's a little tilting at windmills because the amount of the finances behind it, but it's there and it should be encouraged. And one of the reasons for writing this book is let's encourage a little pushback. You know.
So to maybe undo a little bit of the pessimism from.
I apologize. Well,
I want to hear that.
It's my fault.
Oh, yeah,
it's not your fault. It's my.
That's fine.
I should spread out the. You want it?
I want to hear it.
I want to hear him too.
So, okay, quickly, sure.
I'll make it very quick. But to undo some of the pessimism from earlier, going back, because the gentleman in front said it comes down to us, right? And I think if we could, so let's add to the symptom pool, right? But how do we add to the symptom pool, right? And I think this is, in some ways, the all-important question, because if that's what we pull from to be able to express. Right, this unconscious distress that we feel, especially under these glowing times that we live in, right? And then that might very well be the way, or a way of addressing this, is to increase what's in the symptom pool. But I think that has to be, in some ways, to use a word that's already been brought out, indigenously done in terms of what is our lived experience now, and how can we provide a language to that experience that is not corporate, that has not been co-opted, that has not been commodified. That's a very tricky task.
It's an extremely tricky task. Like the idea, so we have this interesting notion of the symptom pool, and the ultimate question is, can you manipulate it? and can you put less symptoms that are less like, you know, that don't kill you. Now, like, let's take anorexia out of the center pool and put in something more benign. Tremendously difficult social engineering required, but I think maybe at the very least, sort of understanding that other places have their own symptom pools and having respect for those symptom pools is possible. Manipulating the symptom pools, not exactly sure that's possible. It's worth thinking about. Yes?
I just wanted to...
No, yes, you. Yeah.
I just wanted to encourage if there were more female voices. Or
yes.
I was
wondering
if you'd be willing to talk a little bit about your what sorts of research you've done into European American and European heritage and history regarding mental illness and the way that it's been treated. You made a little bit of reference to it, but particularly in the historical realm, what can you?
Yeah, no, it's I'm a frustrated anthropologist worldwide when I sort of would oftentimes, you know, use America and the West sort of interchangeably, and it's and for the most part, what I did was it was a grouping. Like, I do think America currently leads the way in these belief systems. Clearly, they got many of those belief systems from Europe, but now that it's coming from America, and I kind of grouped and clumped because I thought it was easier when you saw a more distinct culture than America and Europe. So I did not write about that much. I do think it's fascinating. I mean, I think especially when you study, for instance, the Japanese conceptions of depression and where they arrived from, they basically arrived from Germany. In the early part, there was very much a connection between early Japanese psychiatrists at the beginning of the 1900s studying under European, the one called analyst then, psychiatrist, neuro, I don't know what they're called, but anyway.
It wasn't Freud, it was later?
It was earlier.
Earlier?
Well, yeah. So there's these interesting connections that doesn't all obviously come from America. GlaxoSmithKline itself is an English company with most of its operations here in America, so it gets very confused, but I kind of clumped America and Europe with and compared it to the West.
And I guess, like, what I guess we're trying to get at is, I would like to learn some more about some of the history of where some of the European-American attitudes towards mental illness might come from.
Yeah. Yeah, there's a historian named Edward Shorter, who I just really love. He's written several books. He's the guy that has the idea of the symptom pool, but he's written about the rise and fall of hysteria and the meaning behind that. I think he's a great resource if you're looking for a beginning. Did you have another resource?
Yeah, just early that the London Bills of Mortality was the first classification system of any diseases, and then it went from causes of death to causes of distress. And that was in the 18th century, 1751.
Could you say the name again?
So he didn't mention a name. He was a...
the London something.
London Bill from Calais.
Bill?
Bill. Yes?
So I can't speak too much about the historical perspective in Europe. I'm just thinking a little bit about the current UK perspective around mental health. Because Mike's helping out where I'm from. Let me get away. But I would say, you spoke a little bit about explanatory models, that from a UK perspective, that's certainly something that there's a bit more of investment in within the mental health system, which I think has opened up for a lot more discourse around mental health outside of the diagnosis. So even though the UK looks towards the US for DSM, we, I think, take less of a diagnostic approach and more of an experiential working with the individuals presenting complaint without diagnosis.
That's interesting. As you say that, I think, you know, I do think that a lot of the best critics of American interventions and ideas comes from Canada and from the UK. That's where I found it.
And there's a very strong pride movement in the UK, like you mentioned, from Scotland and from
Any other? I do want to make sure we hear from the biggest spectrum of people as possible. Encourage anyone else to... So the gentleman just behind you. For, yeah, no worries.
I had an interesting experience recently in a classroom watching a documentary called Jupiter's Wife, if anyone has seen that 8, 9, 10 years ago, about a woman in Central Park who was schizophrenic, allegedly schizophrenic, and the filmmaker is getting to know her and the film is developing. You find out at a certain point that she was taking LSD in the late 60s, early 70s. That seems to be, in the discussion we were having and afterwards in the class, where people were focused. The context was LSD madness, and that sort of seemed like an easy context, or, you know, an easy understanding. However, as you discover later in the film, she is hearing voices, as she says, from her husband Jupiter. You know, she has this whole kind of mythological you know, understanding going on, and she says to him at one point, your second baby, your second child will be born on September 13th at 4:30 p.m., which actually happens. His second child is born on September 13th at 4:30 p.m. I mean, it just opens up the whole understanding, the whole awareness opens up to this woman could genuinely, in another culture, she could be taken in to the shaman, some education in the ways of proceedings, the history of, you know, how this works, and she would have that contribution to make to her culture, to her group. Your child will be born on the 13th, 4:30 p.m. Prepare yourself. This is what you need to know, and it's like. We don't have that, by and large. We don't have the broader spiritual possibility, the broader spiritual implications, which actually incorporates magic into the material world.
Yeah.
And that's where I'm living these days.
Yeah.
As it were, I would like to see as much as possible more people exploring that option.
Yeah. I've always tended to be a skeptic in my life. I'm a skeptic and an atheist. But yet, you know, I think the study of this book, I tend to put these things in terms of the value of group belief and the meaning of connection between people as they use narratives. And those narratives can be, you know, just the issue of those narratives being right or wrong or true or false to me is becoming more, less and less material, less and less important. And the ability of those narratives to create bonds and make meaning, even if they're based on myths, I think is ultimately truly human thing to do and a wonderful thing to do. And it can be, of course, there are examples where you can do the same thing and create horrible outcomes and distrust and violence between people. But the stories can be used in a remarkable way. And I think the thing that I end up having to remember is even that biomedical belief about the mind, it represents a set of knowledge and a set of you know, scientific findings. But it also in itself is a narrative. It's a story we say about ourselves. And it is, in that sense, as immaterial and as distant from the truth or falseness as I think other spiritual beliefs. It simply represents a way of thinking about these things that we cannot perceive, and it has certain outcomes. And I'm interested in the outcomes. So does the belief, the magical belief, bind people together and make them kind to each other, or does it do something else? And I'm willing to make room for all sorts of beliefs that that have good outcomes. Regardless of their truth or falsehood. Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to say something about ritual, which is not really just belief, but it's very obvious, like in doing shamanic things. But once you've done that, then you look at your own culture, like watch all the rituals around the football game or something. And we have a lot of really dysfunctional rituals. So it's a lot of this kind of... No, the beating up of women. I mean, how many years was the wrist candy, the wife that the football player beats up when he gets home and he never gets charged? That's built in there. there's a whole lot of stuff. And this is not a, you know, like a religion or anything like that. It's merely going through rituals. That's very much the human, the way humans are built. So I think that, like, we always wanted to make a cargo cult. Right? But it's, yeah, it's. I think it's a real place to be looking at a lot of this stuff. And if you want to add some things that would might be a way to do it. A ritual could be a delivery system.
So maybe we'll take one or two more questions, and then I can share with you the top 10 things you need to know about the Daily Show. So, yes.
I think it was Fippo who talked about like the differences between persons who
can you speak
were
a little bit
mad.
He has a very softer voice.
Sorry. I'm just wondering, I was thinking about Foucault's, I think it was Foucault who talked about the difference between mad acts, people who commit mad acts, and then persons who are mad. And I was just wondering if you ran across that as a cultural difference, like were cultures were more acceptable of madness? Did they look at people less as defined by that and more as something that was a part of them?
Yeah, well, absolutely. I mean, certainly the spirit possession belief in Zanzibar was an example of that, of a way of making a distinction between the person and the act and not having the person defined by... And it was basically they interceded, you know, the narrative is very obvious. You put an entity in between the individual and their act, and you make that entity responsible for the act. And the interesting things about the spirit possession belief in Zanzibar is it's not an uncommon belief. It is... Everyone will say, if you get frustrated and hit your brother, you can employ that spirit possession belief sort of on the micro level of like, oh, spirits can be old deceased relatives. There can be, there's this whole pantheon of spirits that is just fascinating. And it's basically a way to excuse behavior a little bit in a very rather rigid society that has very rigid sort of sets of behaviors, and you can, you know, go off track and momentarily and employ the spirit possession belief, and then you really are acting differently than other people. You can employ it in a longer term way. So,
thanks. So I'm interested in what you said about the biomedical understanding of mental illness itself being a narrative that we tell ourselves as a culture to understand this phenomenon, and wondering if, I mean, it's a very strong narrative, but that is the dominant narrative of our culture and of our understanding of mental health issues. And so I'm wondering how this work for you has intervened on the notion of searching for truth or for objectivity or like basically privileging scientific rationality. If your work has done anything to intervene on that, I see that as an interesting place for us to resist what's going on, just in the way that we talk about mental illness.
Yeah. I still tend to privilege it a great deal, but one of the things you discover, of course, as you look into the science behind certainly Big Pharma, you find that it's not very good science. So there's a lot to be said about just that. So it's, you know, this idea that they promoted this belief that depression is caused by an imbalance of serotonin in your brain. This is a narrative that people tell themselves all the time that they believe is the truth because it is as a scientific patina. But in fact, the belief about the depletion of serotonin or imbalance of serotonin, that the serotonin reuptake inhibitors will rebalance your natural chemicals, is a myth. There is no scientific evidence to suggest that people with depression have a depletion of serotonin or that those SSRIs rebalance your natural chemicals. That's not to say that SSRIs are necessarily always bad or not useful in some cases, but they are a drug like other drugs that have these different outcomes. But people talk, you know, so the GlaxoSmithKline and the people that have created this knowledge and this belief in science have really won this rhetorical battle, and they have people talking about these things as if they're immutable, and they are oftentimes just stories. And the serotonin imbalance thing is a story. You know, if you look into the literature, then no one has evidence that there is an imbalance, and they do believe sometimes that the boost of serotonin will help a depressed person, but like an aspirin will help someone with a headache, but no one claims that as someone that has a headache has a depletion of aspirin in their system. It is a drug that has an effect. It is not this natural rebalancing of a depletion. There's no evidence for that. Not to say it's not a potentially a valuable drug, but so I do second guess the beliefs. I had some very, I wrote a second book that I think I had some very not wise thoughts about the future of psychopharmacology, that it was simply going to be answers that were going to lay in there and they were just going to reveal themselves. Where in fact, lithium was a remarkable advance, I think, in our understanding of the brain as it relates to chemicals. And if the advances had happened as easily over the last, 30 years or since 1970, 40 years, as lithium appeared to be such a remarkable drug, and if we had had advances like that every 2 or 3 years, we would be at a different place, but we have not. And the psychopharmacology of treating mental illness is deeply problematic in terms of its side effects, the science that surrounds it, and the efficacy of these drugs. And hopefully 20 years from now, there'll be more and better knowledge there, but there is not now. So that was a long answer, and I think that I completely missed your question, but maybe we can talk about it more afterwards. Did you have maybe two more comments? And I'll share mine. Yes.
In Chinese medicine, I know that mental illness or mental issues or whatever seem to be the result of like physical problems with the organs and
yes.
particularly the heart and the blood. And I was wondering if you saw any, and I guess you can kind of extend that to like nutritional stuff too. People doing like supplemental therapy or like vitamins. Have you seen that anywhere else in the world? Because I feel like it's actually pretty important, like that part. Like acupuncture is like growing in popularity and acceptance and like.
It's not a silver bullet, of course, yeah, but I think you're right. So there are examples of nutrition, acupuncture.
Where it's not in it's not like the mental illness is in the mind somatic. Or in the spirit world. Yeah, it's in the body.
It's in the body, yeah. I think that is the other fundamental way to think about mental illness is it comes from the body, and things you do to treat the body then would be ameliorative to the person with those experiences. Sing Lee tried to employ those things. Sing Lee is my doctor, the psychiatrist in Hong Kong who dealt with the anorexics, and he had, as any doctor that deals with anorexics, he had patients die, in his care, and he tried everything. And he would try herbalists and Kuizhong, that's right way to say it, masters, and working with their chi and to try to sort of hit the cultural note that would be resonant for this individual. And I have to say, anorexia in Hong Kong proves as resistant to treatment as it does here, almost no matter what cultural narratives you employ. But that doesn't mean that we cannot and import some. So one more thought?
So I just want to say that this whole conversation is really exciting to me, and I'm just really happy to be having it with a room full of people, and that you've been creating this discussion. And I guess I want to share that it's been almost a year since that Times article came out, and people within the Icarus community were having these discussions about what it's like to be a group of people who are living in the heart of the biomedical model, and then seeing it spreading around the world, and wondering what, these questions of like, well, what is our role in this? There's a larger, and I guess I address it to you, but I also just address it to the whole room of people here. There's like a larger global justice movement, and there's like, we're connected in all these different ways, and it's easier than ever to connect with large parts of the world. And it's just this riddle of like, well, what do? We know how fucked up the system is because we're living right in the heart of it, and how do we then take that, not just looking at what people are doing in other places, that we can learn from, but we know how bad it is, how do we share that? I feel like your book does a really great job of sharing that. And I'll say one last thing, which is a couple of years ago, there was an Icarus Project member in India who wanted to start a local Icarus group. And we had this whole conversation about what would that even mean, having an Icarus group in India? The whole premise of our organization is based on fighting against this model, which doesn't exist over there yet. Yeah. But
that makes sense now. Yeah.
So that's my.
Well, thank you for the comment, and thanks for being so attentive. I'd love to have a further conversation afterwards if anyone had another question. I never asked this of audiences, but I would say, like, the one thing that really helps getting a conversation started is if you do happen to blog about these ideas or talk about these ideas online or have a Twitter account or whatever, and some part of this idea sparked something that you want to share in that forum, it's remarkable how those things can resonate in the viral age. So if you happen to be in those conversations, do mention if something struck you here tonight or the book. I would certainly appreciate it. That said, the top 10 things you need to know before going on
vacation.
All right.
Did you tell
us? Here we go. This is it. Number one, do not expect any warm-up. John Stewart comes into the green room before the show and chats with you for about 3 minutes. In my case, the conversation focused exclusively on the contents of my Daily Show gift bag. Number two, you'll have about an hour to hang out and get nervous before you go on. A staff member on the show is there to distract you. In my case, she told me the story of a former interviewee who sweated so profusely that he nearly shorted out the lavalier microphone. To be fair to the staff, and the context of the story was that rarely happens. Number three, you'll only see the set 30 seconds before you walk on. When they need you, a production assistant will lead you down a series of grim hallways past groups of coffee-swilling hipsters, probably writers, hanging out in the break room. You'll be thinking, this is not very glamorous. Your eyes will be drawn to all exit signs. Number four, do not look at the audience as you walk out onto the set. Look only at the familiar face of John Stewart. Know that he will get you through this. Trust in him. Number five, do not think any of the following thoughts. Everyone I know is watching this. Whatever happens in the next 5 minutes will live forever on the web. Better not screw this up. Number six, don't, and this is important, do not try to be funny unless you are funny. If you are not sure you're funny, assume that you are not. And if you try to be in this situation, you look like an incredible jackass because you're sitting next to someone who is preternaturally hilarious. Number seven, when you start to speak, large images of your face will appear on monitors around the set. If you look at these images of yourself, your mind will freeze up and then explode. Look only at John. You'll only have a sentence or two. You'll only have to say a sentence and a half before he'll jump in with a zinger. Number eight, do not laugh too hard at his zingers. They are for the people watching at home. If you start giggling, the interview is going to grind to a halt. Number nine, bask in the post-interview handshake. This is the moment when they're cutting away to commercial and the host leans in to shake your hand and say something just between the two of you. I can't tell you what John said to me during those 5 seconds, except to say that it was of a highly personal nature. Number 10, do not open the copious amounts of liquor in the gift bag until you're out of the building and safely in the town car on the way back to your hotel. Footnote, what is in the Daily Show gift bag? I'm glad you asked. One Monopoly board game, one huge bottle of cherry-flavored vodka, in case you want to get some high school kids hammered after the show. One bottle of 1800 tequila, a package of those espresso packets, but no machine by which to actually make an espresso. One Daily Show hat, one Daily Show t-shirt, and one gift certificate to get a professional photographic portrait of your pet. In case you're ever traveling through New York with your dog. So, thank you so much.
Folks, I just want to mention really quickly before you run off, we're having a raffle, only $1 for this film, that if you enjoyed a lot of what we're talking about tonight, this film embraces and articulates these issues with compassion and creativity and courage. It's about Jax McNamara, who co-founded the Icarus Project, so they're only $1, and they're also for sale for $10, but stick around for the raffle. We're going to draw in just 5 minutes. So, $1.
Thank you.
Sure, that was some
picture. No worries. Okay. All right.
He was very good.
Yeah.
I know, I looked at you when you said that. I was like, yo, this is like therapeutic communication once again.
Oh my god, I'm so happy. Okay, and you have a happy new year.
You too.
Going to Ecuador next week.
Where are you going?
To my country, Ecuador. I'm flying.
Yeah. Oh, for the. Okay. Oh, you'll be back. Okay. Okay, cool. So I won't see you until we start school again.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, have a really awesome time at home.
You too. Thank you.
Bye.
Sorry.
Okay.
Where did the actual tickets go?
They're going in there.
Oh, with the money.
All with the money. I'll separate it out in a second. They have so many hands. Thanks.
Two?
Three. Wow.
When you get there.
What's that? For three dinner.
So who are you working with? Or what is the...
There you go, sir. Thanks.
I have a friend doing a CET company in the military. And they can scale beyond that. Sort of a focus.
Yeah.